Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, healthcare, science in the news, a little bit of politics in the news as well this week, and answers to your questions, emails, and phone calls. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for professional consultation. We'll be coming up to the phone-in section of the show in a few minutes, and I'd like to ask any callers who are waiting to please be patient. A couple of things I really need to announce, one of which is a whooping cough epidemic has been declared in California. There have been 910 children since January. That's 400% of the typical number of cases. And it could be that the number is much greater. Generally, these are reported cases, and whooping cough is often a diagnosis that is not confirmed because no one thinks to check for it. In adults and children who've been vaccinated, as they age, vaccination wanes, and they will get a mild version of whooping cough or pertussis. The mild version of that is basically a very persistent paroxysmal cough. I call it the cough to you puke cough. And if anyone tells me that they, as an adult, have a cough that is coming in waves and making them vomit, I get a blood test for pertussis, and it usually is. It goes through households like wildfire. So another good clue is the domino effect of one person gets sick, a couple days later someone else gets sick, and it has a fairly long incubation period. So who's at risk? Really? Infants under 2 months of age, or anyone who is older who has not been vaccinated. And this is a nasty one. If you get pertussis and you've not been vaccinated, we're talking pneumonia, seizures, and actual brain damage, persistent neurologic damage. This is a really terrible disease for infants to get. So for those unvaccinated children out there, for those parents of unvaccinated children who have opted out of the vaccination cycle, something I do not, repeat, do not recommend, regardless of however many websites say it's a good idea. I've just treated too many infectious diseases to really buy into the idea that vaccines are the greater of two evils. But that aside, if you are going to be around an infant who is unvaccinated, consider getting a booster. We now have a booster that can be given to adults safely. This is a new and an advance. It's the acellular pertussis vaccine called the DTaP. So please, if you are going to be taking care of an infant under 2 months of age or an unvaccinated child, and you can, please get yourself vaccinated so that you don't at least vector it. And I think that if I were choosing daycare for my unvaccinated child, I would want to make sure that at least the care providers were vaccinated so that at least one potential source of infection. Of course, the other children are another story. Anyway, that could generate a lot of discussion. And if you would like to call in and discuss it, I'm fine with that. But the other thing I wanted to put out at the top of the hour was just a little update on what's been going on this week, skin of the teeth sort of passage of, well, a little better than what's been going on the Medicare cuts, but not necessarily a final fix. A six-month reprieve to doctors on that 20% decrease in their reimbursements passed the House. The Senate had earlier passed it by unhooking it from a jobs bill, and the Senate passed it just in time so that now we can resubmit all of our June charges to Medicare if we want to go through the double paperwork burden, which we do, because for 20% of our income, it actually makes sense to do it. It will also, of course, cost the government more to reprocess the claims, but those are small potatoes compared to the big issue. I want to thank those of you who signed the petition that the Texas Medical Association put out there, and thank you for going to the website and signing. I appreciate that very much. We dodged that bullet, but the new bullets will be coming down the line. On the subject of advances this week, we had a little bit of a presentation from our fearless leader about, we have a healthcare bill of rights, and Obama warned insurers not to take advantage of the loopholes in the law, of which there are a great many engineered loopholes. The big issue now at the moment today, the issue du jour, as it were, is premium increases. In the first 6 months of this year, mostly in the first 4 months of this year, premiums for people who were buying insurance on their own, in other words, who weren't buying it through a cooperative, through their employer, jumped 20%. As much as 38% was attempted in California by Anthem. Some of the states actually have regulations that prevent this. The new health care bill, let's call it the Health Insurance Reform Act, that's really what it amounts to, does state that the states will have the charge of regulating that. Funding for the states is drastically limited to actually do a good job, but at least it's a start. There will be regulation of healthcare premium increases, but that doesn't really kick in for a couple of years. So basically, after the next election, we'll actually start to see some benefits from this bill, but I don't know that that's going to be in time. When I say the next election, by the way, folks, I'm talking presidential election, not midterm congressional elections. So it's going to be a long time before we really see what we need to see a real shift in the system. Every little bit helps, but it is still a hugely inequitable, distorted, and exploitative system, and we need to try to fix that for everybody. And just a follow-up on the rate increases for insurance, I forgot to mention California Bill 2578 is a bill that's out there to regulate rate increases, and the State Assembly is looking for comments. So if you're a Californian and would like to weigh in, the phone number to call to voice support for toughening up the California insurance regulation for rate increases is right there on the AskDrDawn.com website. Let's go now to Robert in Soquel. Hello, Robert, and welcome to the program.
Yeah, CPAP question. When I turn up the heat to get a little more humidity so my nose doesn't dry out, then, of course, I get the condensation during the cool times. So I've resorted to very little heat. Then on the dry times, once in a while, I'll wake up and my nose is really hurting because it's dried out. So someone suggested a little olive oil. So I only did it once just a day ago, and I noticed I got a little tickle in my nose. And so all day yesterday, now, I don't know if this is a direct cause, that's why I'm calling.
Mm-hmm.
I was sneezing my head off and still sneezing, and I feel this tickle in the one passage, nasal passage, that is fairly open. I've lived with a deviated septum forever.
Robert, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Yesterday, did you notice any eyes itching or watering?
Yeah, the right eye and the right nostril, I'm getting a lot of drainage and some eye irritation.
I think we have an innocent bystander phenomenon here with the olive oil. We're in prime grass allergy season right now.
That's why.
Yeah, exactly. And let me tell you, it hits like a ton of bricks. And if you have eye symptoms, I can't figure out a way physiologically to attribute any eye symptoms to putting olive oil in your nose.
Okay, but the little tingle in my good nasal passage, along with the tingle, I sneeze.
Yeah, I think that you probably are experiencing a reaction, allergic reaction to airborne allergens at the moment.
All right.
But I want to problem solve your CPAP for you a little bit. This is something that a lot of people have difficulty with. Now, continuous positive airway pressure is our not very good technological solution for sleep apnea. It is the best we've got because it works for the greatest majority of people with obstructive sleep apnea who apply just a few millimeters of mercury, just a little air pressure inside the nose, are able to keep their palate from closing and keep their airway from occluding at night when they're asleep and everything starts to relax and sag and want to stick together. So, as I said, it's a not very good technology because it involves a device and it has to blow air into your nose. Many, many people have difficulty finding a mask that fits without irritating. Many people react and develop rashes. Many people just can't sleep when they've got the thing on. And I have to tell you, I'd say at least 50% of the time the CPAP device sits there and gathers dust after the first couple of months. However, there are individuals whose lives have been transformed by it, and I've also heard from them, and they will feel so much better with their sleep apnea treatment that they are willing and committed and motivated to find the right mask. And there are like 40 different masks for a reason.
Well, so, I think I'm part of that group. I'm not obsessed with it. I'm happy with my mask. If you have a hint for me, a tip for me on using the mask and
the picture
and so forth, that's fine.
I do. And what my hint is going to, you'll find a little bit amusing, I think. The silicone-based sexual lubricants are designed for use in mucous membranes. So they are very, very safe to put in your nose. And they have a much longer duration of action. So unlike Vaseline or oil, Vaseline, of course, reacts with the latex, and so we don't like to mix those two. It'll degrade your mask.
Uh-huh.
Olive oil is a very lightweight oil and will to gum up the inside of your passageways. So these silicone-based sexual lubricants are a really good strategy. They're easy on latex. They won't interfere with your device. And they persist on the mucous membranes, and they keep it moisturized and smooth. So you might try using one of those.
I'm holding in my hand. I don't have my reading glasses on, and it's pretty small type. But am I allowed to say the name of the product?
Of course.
Astroglide?
I don't know if that is silicone-based or not off the top of my head.
Okay.
I don't think it is, but you could contact the manufacturer. And certainly any product that is designed for the use of your mucous membranes below the belly button is going to be fine for your mucous membranes above the belly button.
And so silicone-based is the operative term.
Right.
All right.
All right.
Well, thank you very, very much, Dr. John. Your erudition always impresses me.
And I'm impressed you can pronounce erudition.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. By the way, follow up on the question about Astroglide. Astroglide is purified water, glycerin, and propylene glycol. Thank you for that, Charlie. Let's go to Bill in Monterey. Hello, Bill. We seem to have a sleep apnea day.
Yes. Well, just because in some ways, diagnosed with me at age 49, and I wasn't severely overweight, which is normally the case, and I didn't even realize I had it, other than the fact that I could never remember my dreams in the morning, and it turned out I never got into the REM state because I wasn't ever getting that far along because I would stop breathing about 80 times an hour.
Wow, you had pretty severe sleep apnea. How low did your oxygens get?
I didn't see the readings on that.
That's the one I always look at, because if your oxygen drops below 90, you're losing brain cells. Not good.
Well, it was interesting is that I, now realize that, the fact that I couldn't remember my dreams, everybody just thought it was crazy, and it was because I never dreamed. So once I got an operation, which meant 6 days of misery drinking Similac, it was, because I didn't want to be hooked up to a CPAP machine for the next 30 years.
So you had your, and the thing actually that's important about you is you said you weren't overweight. And typically the people who are the best candidates for that surgery are the people who have sleep apnea and aren't overweight, because they've got something structural in their throat that's giving them the sleep apnea in the first place, and you can carve away at the structure.
Exactly, and that was where, I guess, given the option of the machine or the week of misery, it was like I opted for the week of misery, and so 10 years later, it's like I'm not using the machine, not snoring at night, so my partner's a lot happier, and dreaming, of course, have dreams, so it's, and of course, the health risk of the stroke was the primary concern.
Yes.
But, so surgery is certainly something that people don't like to think of. They think anything but surgery, but I guess I decided that, a week of surgery recovery was better than decades of alternative approaches.
Yes, I think that was a very good decision on your part, and obviously it's worked out well for you. Anything else to add?
We do actually have an excellent surgeon in the Monterey area, Dr. Auerbach, who does this, probably about 5 surgeries a week. So we actually have somebody that is very experienced, very knowledgeable, where you don't have to go up to Stanford to get treatment, which is also novel.
Yeah, in general, there's kind of a rule of thumb for most surgical procedures. If you can find somebody who's doing 50 a year, then you're going to have the lowest complication rate from your surgery. That's kind of a number that's been arrived at just on the basis of how human brains and coordination work. So a good question in general. And you said he was doing 5 a week. So he's obviously making that 50 a year mark with room to spare.
Yes.
Very good.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I'm going to go to some emails, a couple I didn't get done last week and a couple from this week, from Catherine in Aromas. Dear Dr. Don, the other morning, upon getting up, I realized I had a burning sensation on my hand above my thumb. There was a red spot, and I thought I'd been bitten by an insect or spider. We'd been sleeping on our screened-in porch. About 2.5 hours later, after I first noticed the bite, I realized my hand was sweating in the area immediately around the bite. It continued to sweat all day and all evening. When I woke up this morning, the size of the bite had gone down from about 0.5 inch to less than 0.25 inch, and the swelling had stopped, but it started up again this afternoon. My question is, how does this localized diaphoresis work, and what's the reason for it? I understand that black widows can cause localized diaphoresis. I tried to understand the physiology using Google, and all I can come up with is that black widow toxin works through a calcium-mediated mechanism that causes the release of acetylcholine and norepinephrine, and that sweating involves the sympathetic cholinergic nerves and is controlled by the hypothalamus. I can't be certain if the creature involved was a black widow, but in any case, if sweating is ultimately controlled by the hypothalamus far away from the site of the bite, why is the reaction so local? I suppose that the highest concentration of the toxin would be closest to the bite site. Catherine, I want to congratulate you. You totally nailed what's going on. And the only piece missing, and the question that you're asking, is why localized? And the answer is because normally the mechanism that the hypothalamus uses to control sweating is mediated by the release of acetylcholine from the synapses. So the synapses of those nerves that originate in the hypothalamus go out to the skin, and in the skin, they release acetylcholine, which then is received by receptors on the sweat glands. With me so far? Well, in the case of the black widow bite, what you have is a cholinergic effect. So acetylcholine is present due to the effect of the toxin. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the effect is that the acetylcholine is not broken down. So you get a magnification of the response and increased sweating. Anticholinesterases are actually a common form of toxic exposure, and we see that in many plants, and we also see it in many of our pesticides. So the issues with acetylcholine and acetylcholinesterase inhibition are commonly associated with various types of envenomation and poisoning. It's something that can readily be thrown off, and often is, by biological compounds that are present in the environment. Certain plants, for example, like Jimson weed and angel's trumpet, which is Datura, will affect the cholinergic system as well. So thank you for an interesting little foray into the realm of pharmacology and toxicology. And let's go to Kathleen in Carmel Valley. Hello, Kathleen, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I'm moving to an area where fluoride is present in the soil, and the figure, I don't have the exact figure, seems to straddle the line between federal and California numbers. And I began reading about it, and Dr. Bonner had made a product that had magnesium and calcium in it, and he discontinued that for some reason. Do you have anything to offer that I'll be drinking water which is not fluoridated? But the rest of the use will involve that.
Okay, I'm really having trouble parsing your question. Can you rephrase it for me? I've got the background now, but I don't understand your specific question.
I'm moving to an area where fluoride is present in the soil.
In the soil. And what is the water source going to be where you're moving?
It'll be a well.
So you're going to be drinking from a well. So your question is, am I getting enough fluoride in my well water? Is that?
No. Okay. How can I counteract that there's quite a bit of it in the water?
And you know that for a fact. It's been tested and you see that the fluoride levels are high.
Yes.
You've looked at the water testing.
Yes.
Okay, got it. The simplest way to do that would be to buy a reverse osmosis system for your house. I'm a great fan of RO systems in situations where you're on a well, because you get rid of the nitrates, you get rid of the bacteria. If there is E. coli contamination in your well, that's not going to be a problem after it's gone through an RO system. But you also get rid of these solutes and things like fluoride. And if you're on a water system that's a city water system, the chlorine and the chlorine byproducts, some of which are potentially quite toxic. So this is a way of eliminating that issue. That would be your simplest solution. I don't feel that buying bottled water is a good idea, both either for the planet or, for that matter, much bottled water is just tap water that's been put through an RO system. So why not just eliminate the middleman? The middleman, yeah.
Since it's in a well and there are other people on, who will be taking from the well, does reverse osmosis take about three times as much water to process it?
It does. But if you're using it for your drinking water, not for your shower water and your bathing water and the water you're using to water the plants and clean the house, then that isn't going to be a particularly large amount of your water take from the well, and I think it's legitimate to do that.
Okay, thank you so much.
Oh, let me see. Besides RO, this is from my producer who's sitting there now filtering the web for me. There's something called the Activated Alumina Defluoridation Filter. And
Activated
Alumina. They would remove fluoride, but they cost about $30 a filter, and the filters require frequent replacement, but presumably they don't take the three times of the water of toll that the RO does.
And it's called Activated Alumina?
Uh-huh. Like aluminum, but alumina.
And that's all. If I look on the web, I can find it through that.
Right. Defluoridation filter. It's specifically for removing fluoride. And just FYI, Brita and the other charcoal filters are not fluoride removal devices. They will not take fluoride out.
Okay, so in order to find it on the internet, I look under defluoridation filter.
Yes.
And then look under, activated alumina. I'm not very...
That should do it. That should do it just fine. You just put that into a browser and you should be able to locate it.
Thank you so very much.
You're welcome, and I hope everything goes well in your new home.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Another email from Santa Cruz. This is anonymous. Dear Don, I really wanted to call and speak to you, but I'm not too confident of what my question is, so I thought I'd just write. I'm a 28-year-old female in very good health. However, since adolescence, I've been between 15 and 30 pounds overweight. I try to be active and eat right, but I'm plagued by a sugar addiction. Even though I know it's not good for me, I have a very hard time saying no when it's there in front of me. Especially after every meal, I feel like I'm not done eating unless I have something sweet. I do eat a lot of vegetables and try especially to eat dark leafy greens at least daily. Do you have any advice or experience with patients who may have had success kicking a sugar addiction? Is it physiological or psychological support that is more important? Thank you for any advice. So, anonymous, it depends on the person, but sugar addiction is largely both psychological and physiological. The physiological piece is related to what did you eat this morning, what did you eat last night, and it's fairly short-lived. The adaptations that will kick in under a week. So if you go to a low simple carbohydrate diet, and that means not just sugar, but where you may be missing the boat is starch. So things like bread, muffins, pasta, things that aren't sweet. Although really, when you eat white flour and you really taste it, it does taste sweet in your mouth. Those all cause the release of insulin. And so during your detox phase, what you have to do is stay away from starchy things as well as sweet things. And be sure that you eat in the morning no sweets or sugars, no starches, and a high protein. So, plain yogurt with some actual fruit in it would be fine. Eggs would be fine, but you need protein in the morning with no carbohydrates to speak of. And then as you go through the day, as you get later and later in the day, you can eat a little bit more carbohydrates. But during the first week, I recommend that you have very low simple starch, very low sugar diet. And at the time when you would ordinarily be craving the sweet taste, and this is a trick from TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, go for something sour. Citrus, maybe a slice of lemon with some salt on it to essentially control the sweet tooth. And it sounds bizarre, but vinegar and citrusy flavors do reduce sugar cravings. And it's a short-term fix because that's really all you need is a short-term fix. From the physiological standpoint, you'll be through that aspect of the withdrawal quickly. It'll not work, by the way, if you eat flour, pasta, and non-sweet starches during this period. You won't get the change in your physiology. Now, to come to the psychological support, hypnosis can really work. Avoidance is very helpful. Just don't put it in front of you. The thing about dieting is that you can't stop eating, but you can control what you eat. Quitting smoking, you know, it's very hard to quit smoking if you're living in a house with smokers, but if you aren't and you stay away from smokers, that really assists in quitting smoking. As far as sweets are concerned, you really need to take a look at your household, talk to people, see if you can shift to the household dynamic. And if you can't, getting up, leaving the table, and doing the sour, vinegary flavor thing that I'm talking about will help with that psychological association. And in the short run, it'll be a willpower game to get through. After a week or so, it gets a lot easier. So I want to encourage you to try. In the long run, we're looking at a society that is pathologically dependent on processed foods, on simple sugars, on empty calories. And we are looking at a society that is succumbing to the burden of obesity, of diabetes, of sugar and starch overload. We need to rethink our eating patterns in a social way, in a global way. We're way too far down the wrong track, and we're starting to really see the attrition that it's causing on our health. It's very, very important that we all seek and reward systems, particularly social systems, restaurants, schools that are trying to show another alternative. Vote with your mouth. Go into the convenience store and only buy the stuff that's healthy. You'll have to hunt for it. There are a few things, even in 7-Eleven, that are actually not bad for you. Go and buy them. Buy them all. Make them stock more. That's the way we need to change our society, one bite at a time. Time for one more email. This from Tom in Woodridge, Illinois. I listened with much interest to your June 12, 2010 topic on D-ribose. I went to my local health food store to see what they sold, and I found nothing smaller than, I think, 800 milligrams. Did you mean 5 grams and not 5 milligrams on the air? Well, Tom, you get a prize. If I had a book, I would give it to you. Since I don't have a book, I'll just have to give you good credit for catching an error. You got me. Yes, I did mean 5 grams. Typical dosing for D-ribose with exercise would be 5 grams, not 5 milligrams. That one got through my several error filters, and so I want to congratulate you. Tom bought a Now Brand chewable tablet of 1,500 milligrams, 1.5 grams. That's a good dose for use for exercise, congestive heart failure, even fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue can benefit. I do want to just tell Tom that a dose of 1,500 milligrams may actually, in the short term, lower your blood sugar. So if you are diabetic using insulin, you could drop your blood sugar a lot with that dose. So you want to be careful in that circumstance. For most of the rest of us, it's not a problem. One more. Deb in Illinois writes, uterine fibroids. I download your podcast and listen to them while I'm out on my daily exercise walks. I've been diagnosed with uterine fibroids. One is 6 centimeters by 7 centimeters by 7 centimeters, which is a small apple, folks. Another is about 3 centimeters, which is, you know, about a walnut. Also noted many other small ones. I'm 53 years old, but not in menopause. I have heavy bleeding and menstrual pain. My doctor prescribed low estrin 24 to help with the heavy bleeding. I've read some articles on shrinking fibroids naturally. Are there natural methods to reduce these fibroids that are successful? If you've spoken about this, let me know the date of the podcast. Other than fibroids, I'm in good health, not overweight, and try to eat a healthy diet, get healthy exercise. I really enjoy listening to your radio show. Thank you, Deb, in Illinois. And, you know, you're 53 years old, so you're headed for the absolutely best natural fibroid shrinkage method there ever was, which is called menopause. When your ovaries, which from your sounds of your symptoms, you are estrogen dominant. You probably have a lot of estrogen in your system. When your ovaries stop producing estrogen sometime in the next couple of years on most timetables that would be typical, you will experience a natural shrinkage of your fibroids. Will it be enough to reduce your pain? I don't know, but there's an excellent chance that it will be. So the very first thing I would recommend is just hanging in there and waiting and seeing. A second thought is that using progesterone inside the uterus might really reduce your periods and allow you not to use the estrogen and the low estrin. So my thought would be with you, I would look at maybe a Mirena IUD. If the fibroids don't distort the inside lining of the uterus so much that it's impossible to get an IUD in there, that would be very helpful for you. The use of natural progesterone topically has not been shown to shrink fibroids, although I'm sure there are people on the web who will tell you it has. There's no good scientific data about that. Using Vitex or soy protein or some of the other products which are natural estrogen ligands, that is to say, they will fit in the estrogen receptor, but they aren't as strongly able to stimulate the receptor. So they'll block some of your own estrogen and minimize your estrogen dominance. And that would be another natural strategy. I would probably go to the chasteberry Vitex in combination with either soy protein or black cohosh to see what sort of results I got. And the idea there is that you're blocking the estrogen receptor so that your own estrogen isn't getting on there and stimulating the heck out of the fibroids to keep growing. This is a temporizing measure, but it might be enough, especially given your age. Let's talk to Tony in Santa Cruz. Hello, Tony, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dar.
Hi there.
I'd like to say I was a longtime listener. I was shocked when I heard you were on for 9 years. I'm a local Santa Cruz person, and I caught you by accident.
By mistake. Go ahead and say it.
Last year. Well, yes, but your voice is so intriguing, and your range of knowledge seems to. I was married to a doctor. She's gone now, but anyway, I know a lot about the medical thing, but I've been doing the CPAP thing because my weight went up to 270. I'm trying to get down to 200 as a way of getting rid of the CPAP. But one thing bothered me, the local doctor said that from the looks of my graphs after I took the sleep test, that there might be something in my brain causing the apnea. Does that sound right to you?
Well, there are two kinds of sleep apnea. There's central sleep apnea and obstructive sleep apnea. And the obstructive one is where the tissues of the throat relax and literally block the passage of air. Whereas the central one has to do with the breathing pacemaker in the medulla oblongata. In terms of reading that from the graphs, I'm not a sleep expert, so I don't know the nuances of how one would do that. But I expect that there is a possibility that you could have central sleep apnea.
I didn't have it until I gained a lot of weight.
Well, that's just it. And the other thing is that CPAP shouldn't help with central sleep apnea. Because all you're doing with CPAP is keeping the lower airway from, or rather the upper airway from occluding. So if the pacemaker is messed up, then the pacemaker is messed up. You can open up the passageway and you're still not going to have good movement of air. At least that would be how I would understand it. Central sleep apnea may be what causes crib death, by the way.
I see. Right.
So just, you know, to kind of put it in context.
Could I give you a little more about my situation? I can sleep without the CPAP machine if I'm sleeping on my side, but if I roll on my back, that's when I get into problems.
I think you need to lose weight and forget about the comment that the
sleep
apnea doctor made.
There is a thing, an appliance that dentists can give you for a couple thousand bucks that has, in my case, of several of my friends, totally replaced the CPAP machine. Are you familiar with that?
I am, and it works in some people. If you were to test it across a large group of people, it would not reach statistical significance, but there are definitely anecdotal reports. And I think what you do is if you do a study where you select people who have a certain structure,
right,
and then you fix the structure,
I'll go with your advice. Yeah. I'm 75 years old, and I think if I drop 60 or 70 pounds, I think my problem will...
I think you should go back to the weight that you were at before you had sleep apnea.
That's it.
And then... if nothing else, you will have a significant improvement in your sleep apnea. Whether or not it will be total improvement remains to be seen, because as you got older and gained the weight, you stretched things out.
Last question, though. Should I have another test routine after I drop 50 pounds or so?
You bet.
Okay, one last thing. About 10% of the reason for my call was you're mentioning erudite. Well, in my experience, and I have a dictionary, it says there are two different pronunciations of that word, erudite and erudite. So I don't know if you do that.
I did not, but I appreciate that. And now I feel better. I feel so much better.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. And let's talk to James in Felton. Hello, James. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Well, I'm calling about cramping mainly in legs, ankles, feet, sometimes higher. But... I do a lot of physical movement and, climbing and working and with my legs, And I try to stretch well and do some yoga stretches and stuff, and I'm getting less flexible, not more flexible. And I'm curious about things like my old swimming teacher when I was a kid used to say to eat more salt. And then there's calcium. And then is it okay for somebody who's 50-something to drink milk? Can I drink like low-fat milk? And do you have some other better ideas for how to deal with cramping?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Let's start with the idea that when your muscles cramp, that's generally a problem with a balance of ionized compounds, ions, in the muscle. So supposedly, you've got calcium coming out of the muscle when the muscle contracts, and then the calcium has to get pumped back into essentially the endoplasmic reticulum and hidden there, and that allows the muscle to relax. So you think in terms of what happens when you die and you have rigor mortis. What's going on there is that your cells no longer have any energy, and so they can't pump the calcium back out to release the muscles. So the muscles lock up, and then eventually that releases through a different physiologic process, which we won't go into because it's kind of gross. But muscle cramps are essentially a problem with pumping that calcium back in. It turns out that magnesium is really important in that, because the calcium and magnesium get traded off with each other. So to pump the calcium back into the endoreticulum, you need to pump magnesium out. And if you don't have enough magnesium, you can't do it. So most cramping is actually magnesium deficiency. So the first thing to do is to find a salt of magnesium that doesn't give you diarrhea and consume it in large enough quantities. Now, one of the diarrhea cures that we all think of traditionally when we were babies, we probably were given it milk of magnesia. And it is magnesium in a insoluble form that doesn't break down well, doesn't get absorbed well. So it sits in your intestine and pulls water into the intestine and helps you poop. What you want is the opposite. You want a magnesium that's going to dissociate in the intestine and absorb into the bloodstream and therefore get to the muscles. So magnesium citrate, magnesium glycinate are the two salts that I really like for this purpose.
Okay, I'm going to write that down.
You bet.
Do they not come in calcium-magnesium combinations that you get in pills?
They do, but it isn't in the best form, and the dose isn't ideal.
Thank you. Okay, so what was the other word besides magnesium that you said twice?
Glycinate. Now, that's glycine 8.
Thank you.
And glycine's an amino acid. It's a small little amino acid, and you bind that to the magnesium, and it breaks up in the intestine very nicely. And the glycine actually gets absorbed and is a precursor for GABA, which is your relaxation neurotransmitter in your brain. So I find that taking the magnesium glycinate at night helps people sleep and helps with muscle cramps.
Oh, great. So those are definitely related.
You bet. So it's kind of a win-win. How much magnesium? Well, that depends on how much you can take without getting the runs. But I just tell people, you know, start with 200, double it, go to 400. If you can tolerate 400, try 600 at bedtime. You'll figure out how much is too much.
Okay, and so that's the word. There was another word that you said after magnesium, too.
Citrate.
Citrate.
Like citric acid, but citrate.
Okay, and that's something to also include?
That's an alternative to the glycinate and also readily breaks down and readily absorbed.
Okay, and so if they're available separately in pill form?
That's right.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Don.
Call me back and let me know how that works out for you.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Let's go to Christoph in Santa Cruz. Hello, Christoph.
Don.
Hi.
Hello. My blood pressure is coming down significantly from 161 over 74 to 151. Over 74 within 6 weeks, and I'm gonna get it further down, you know, because it was just too high, and I'm 77 years old, but otherwise in fairly good health. One problem with I'm getting too much tofu. How do you make it tasty? You know, it's so flat and no salt, of course.
Of course. Well, all right, so some cooking tips here. First of all, tofu is a really wonderful source of soy protein, but there are other sources that might even be better. And so I'm going to mention tempeh, T-E-M.
Tempeh, yeah, I'm tempeh. Familiar with it, yes.
Okay, tempeh is a very nice source of protein, and there are a lot of good recipes. In fact, if you go to the Dawn Motika Facebook page, you'll actually find a link to a wonderful tempeh recipe on Facebook. A friend of mine did this for a cooking contest, and so I posted the link. My husband did the video for it, so it's just one of those little family things that you put up on Facebook. But anyway, so Dawn Motika will find that if you want to go look for the link to a good tempeh recipe. Other ways of making soy tasty without making it salty, which is a trick. I like to use ginger. A little bit of ginger and garlic is a wonderful combination. You can put that in some olive oil and just lightly braise the tofu. And the other thing about the tofu is squeeze out the moisture. So put it under a plate, a couple of plates or a board, put some weight on it, squeeze out the moisture. And then when you put it in a sauce, it'll suck the sauce in. So you could use things like low-fat tomato sauce, or you can use a curry, or, you know, whatever sorts of sauces. I find that salad dressings actually work very well. So like a balsamic vinegar, olive oil salad dressing with some spices, maybe some dill or some oregano. And then you put that compressed tofu in there and it'll suck in the dressing and hold it in, give it a very nice flavor.
Mm-hmm. How long about?
I would press it for about an hour. Soak out as much moisture as you can.
Yeah.
And then just drop it in there for, you know, 15, 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm. By the way, there's a tofu at Trader Joe's that has very low water, hardly any. I mean, they have several kinds of tofu.
I know. And, you know, I haven't found that one to absorb very well.
Uh-huh.
It has more structure, so it's good for stir frying. It doesn't break up.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to suck up the moisture the way that the pressing the wet tofu and then letting it suck back in your sauce trick works.
Yeah, okay.
Okay?
Okay.
And I wanted to emphasize, you did something else to lower your blood pressure. You reduced your salt?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I cut it out completely.
And did you make any other changes? Did you add potassium, for example?
No, but potassium I may need because my sleep can be a problem.
Mm-hmm. There's a salt substitute made of potassium chloride, which can further lower blood pressure in people who have reduced it by salt reduction. It's slightly bitter tasting compared to table salt, but it mixes nicely with a little lemon juice on vegetables. Mm-hmm. So that's a strategy.
Yeah.
And potassium does lower blood pressure, as does magnesium. We were talking about magnesium for muscle cramps, and I mentioned it helps relax muscles.
Yeah.
Well, one of the muscles that it helps relax is the muscles of the blood vessel wall.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another additional thing that I always use when someone comes in with high blood pressure. In my office, they get given the DASH diet, which is 7 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables, daily calcium, extra magnesium, daily exercise, walking at least 20 minutes a day.
Yeah, I do that.
And then I tell them, if you do all of these things, and depending on their blood pressure, I might also give them arginine at high doses. If you do all of these things, there's a really good chance that you won't need drugs. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how often people who will actually change their behavior, which is at least 50% of the population, if I sell it correctly, will at least attempt behavior change. Whether they succeed often depends on whether they have supportive spouse and supportive friends versus friends who are sabotaging them. And that does occur, unfortunately, a great deal of the time. But at least 50% of people will try. And I'm throwing that out there, not for you, because, Christoph, you're an obvious evidence of what happens when people do try to change, but to the doctors and nurses out there who are kind of giving up and have just said, it takes too long, I'm not reimbursed, what the hell, where's the prescription pad? Yes, that's all true, but you get a different kind of reimbursement when you help someone change their life for the good. And yeah, you don't get paid for that in money, but there are other types of payment, and it's a very, very fulfilling thing to do. So do make the effort to sell behavior and teach behavior to your patients, folks. Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. And wait, my producer just put this up. You can go to Cook Tempeh on YouTube, And mm-hmm. our video is at the top of that list. So yeah. if you just search the words cook tempa, you'll find all kinds of wonderful recipes. And an off-air caller, somebody listening, just called in and gave us a website called Compassionate Cooks, one word, compassionatecooks.com. And she says, or he says, there's lots of good vegan recipes, videos, books, and lots of soy and tempeh information there.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's go to June in Monterey.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I want to try to be articulate. I don't want to get all over the place. First of all, I read an article, I can't remember from where, but it said that because of the fact that certain racial groups have a higher propensity for hypertension or certain, you know, diseases, it doesn't always portend fatality. Now, I'm an African-American, and I'm diagnosed with hypertension. What happened is that I got a diverticulitis, and they wanted to operate, and they said they couldn't operate until I brought my blood pressure down, and they gave me this medication, which turned out to be worse than the disease. I was getting delusions and side effects. I'm certainly not faulting them. I mean, they
so, yes, but you stopped that medication, right? You're off.
Absolutely.
Okay,
it's
good.
Been about 6 months, and I'm now back. I was losing my memory. I was becoming confused and literally slobbering. It was so horrible. And I'm back to the point now where I got my memory back, because even though I'm in my 70s, my mind was still sharp.
Sure. Tell me, what's your blood pressure now?
I don't know. I haven't had it taken in a while.
Okay. I'm gonna shake my finger at you.
All right.
Go down to Costco or to your local pharmacy and get yourself a cuff.
Yeah.
And start monitoring your blood pressure. All right. This is like brushing your teeth or flossing for you.
Well,
this is health maintenance, all right? Don't give me any guff on this. This is not rocket science. If you've got two arms and an eyeball, you can do it.
I know how to do it. It's just that what I'm talking about is I had worse, as I said, I'm not faulting
You're
my doctor.
You're saying that you had a problem.
I had worse reactions from the medication than I had before.
Then I guess we have to figure out something besides medication to help you.
Well, can I change my diet?
Good.
And they put me on an all liquid diet, which I follow pretty much routinely, low salt, low fat, low sugar. But what I wanted to say, I read an article that certain populations, high blood pressure is not necessarily fatal. Always fatal. I know I'm all over the map, and
mm-hmm.
forgive me.
Yeah.
But what happened now, I've lost 40 pounds.
Excellent.
And being on the liquefied diet and the veggies and I hardly ever eat meat anymore. I eat it sometimes.
Good. Now you've lost 40 pounds. Your blood pressure problem may have taken care of itself.
Well, I guess that's what I wanted to bring up. I mean, this article I read said that sometimes the medical professionals make too much of high blood pressure when it's, you know, certain populations, because the certain populations have a propensity for it.
Well, I think that the idea that there's some kind of racial or ethnic protection against stroke and heart attack isn't really borne out by the data. We see, for example, in the Japanese, they eat a very healthy diet, but they do consume a lot of salt in their diet, and they do have a lot of hypertension, very low cancer rates, very low heart attacks, but lots of hypertension and lots of strokes. Strokes are no fun. We can look at other populations. We can look at Africans versus African Americans, and we can see really big differences in event rates. But we also see big differences in lifestyles and in diets. And so it's hard to draw conclusions about ethnicity when you have all of these other variables along for the ride. You see what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. And one more question. I don't want to take up all the time. I'm thinking of going in for a hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any views on or any experience with hypnosis?
Actually, funny you should ask. I'm a certified hypnotist, although I don't do a lot of hypnotherapy in isolation. I tend to use that with my acupuncture quite a bit. You would be using it for weight loss or for some other purpose?
Well, to bring the blood pressure down.
For blood pressure lowering, I think it's an excellent idea to the extent that what remains of your high blood pressure is related to stress and just your having a high sympathetic tone. Hypnosis is very effective at helping people relax and reducing the amount of fight or flight response. You can also change things in really fundamental ways with hypnosis, and I don't understand the mechanism except to say that the mind-body connection is very, very powerful.
It is, because so, I'll tell you, I stopped smoking with hypnosis years and years and years ago. And also, you had another caller a little bit ago talking about her weight and fluctuating, because, see, that's how I can make myself do things. I mean, and also neuro-linguistic programming, which mm-hmm. is like a conjunct of self-hypnosis.
Yes, it is.
The self-suggestion. I mean, I would just say to this person, you could say, well, you know, I think I'm full now. Oh, well, you know, that's all I need.
Yes,
I mean,
those types of things. June, we're done, unfortunately, with the show, but let's leave it with self-talk, the mind-body connection, self-programming, visualize your goals, and they become real. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed the program as much as I have. I'll be back next week to take more of your calls and your emails and discuss more health and science in the news. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.